Number 8, it's my honor to introduce Chancellor Arnold M. Eisen. And Arnie Eisen is one of those people who proverbially needs no introduction. So I'm going to, in my brief remarks, I'm going to tell a story that Harold Berman and I experienced earlier today. This morning we made a visit to the George W. Bush Presidential Museum, which I highly recommend. It's very close to the hotel. It's really beautiful. And it was just interesting to see the reaction of the visitors to the museum, especially when we bumped into Arthur Levinsky, who was in Tullis and Film. We did bump into Arnie, that part is true. And I segue that to this introduction. I'm not quite sure how, but I segue that to this introduction because there are places that take on the quality of Makom Kadosh. And whereas for some, the Bush Library may fulfill that qualification, for many of us, for a long time, JPS in New York has been a Makom Kadosh. And one of the privileges that those of us involved in RA stuff get to come to New York a lot and be at the seminary, it's always exciting to enter JTS, and to this day it strikes me as being a Makom Kadosh, and today largely because of the influence of Chancellor Arnold Eisen. Because Arnie has brought to the seminary not only his profound understanding of Jewish philosophy and sociology, an understanding of the nature of the world Jewish community today and where that community could be headed with the right direction, but also the importance of maintaining the seminary as a true Makom Kadosh, Kedusha defined by serious commitment to learning, serious commitment to mitzvot, to Medinat Yisrael, to the Jewish people. And for doing all these wonderful things, it is my honor and privilege at this moment to introduce Chancellor Arnie Eisen.
Thank you. So, a couple years ago, we edited the blog series that I've been doing about conservative Judaism, and we put it together in a booklet, which was called Conservative Judaism Today and Tomorrow. You all have, or will soon have, the latest graphically improved version of this. And you should know it's going to be an e-book. It's going to be available for 99 cents on iTunes, and we are going to publish discussion guides and videos and anything we can do to help you lead a discussion about what conservative Judaism stands for. We're happy to do it, JTS. I start this way not only to plug the booklet, but to say that in the last year, to my surprise, the title of the booklet became a controversy. I thought it was pretty uncontroversial to talk about conservative Judaism today and tomorrow. But then there were all these voices we heard saying that in light of the Pew Report, conservative Judaism barely has a today and certainly has no tomorrow, that we're doomed to imminent disappearance. Most of the people saying these things should have known better. Some of them who said these things do know better, but they said them anyway. And so I found myself on the road a lot this year, giving dozens and dozens of talks about the future of conservative Judaism, which try to combine some insight into what's going on and why the Pew Report did what it did and how we should think about it, with some more longer-term thinking about what conservative Judaism has always been and what it should be. What I'm going to try to do in the next few minutes as we lead our way up to honoring Amy a little later is share some of those thoughts with you in the hope that this is a conversation that will continue here and in the years to come, because we have no greater partners. We, JTS, have no greater partners than you all in making sure that conservative Judaism remains the vibrant and substantive movement that it has been for so long. So let me say, I'm going to try to encapsulate what I've learned and try to communicate in five or six different lessons. And the first of those lessons is that, as Rosenzweig said, it's not a time for proof. It's a time for testimony. It's a time for witnessing. We can't prove that our path is right. We can't prove that our path is true. We stand for it. And I found that it was particularly important as Chancellor of JTS not to give a scholarly presentation, about the origins of conservative Judaism and trace the coherent, to my mind, cogent, compelling narrative that we tell that starts with Zacharia Frankel and goes through Salman Schechter and goes down to a present day, which is a course I teach a lot at JTS. But to speak personally, and I found that it meant a lot to conservative congregants to hear me speak this way, because one of the things that Pew Report has occasioned, and these critiques of conservative Judaism have occasioned, is a rather pernicious notion that conservative Jews are second-rate Jews. That there are more serious Jews out there. That if you're a conservative Jew, you've made compromises, dictated by reality to be sure, but if you were really serious, if you were really courageous, you wouldn't be a conservative Jew. And so I found myself speaking not as Chancellor of JTS in the first instance, not as scholar of American Judaism, not as a person with a PhD in modern Jewish law, etc., etc., but as a conservative Jew. And I would say things like, I'll never forget the moment when my daughter was bat mitzvah, which is one of the greatest moments of my life. And that's not just a moment that I owe to Judaism, that's a moment that I owe to conservative Judaism. Because, of course, a girl can be bat mitzvahed in other places as well, but to stand up there and daven shacharit and lein and do haftorah and do a dvar Torah, etc., etc., and lead the congregation is a bat mitzvah that we invented. It's a role for women that we pioneered. It's something that a person of our generation is thankful for, the fact that you live in this generation and you live as a conservative Jew so you can take advantage of it. And with any historical sense, you know that outside conservative Judaism today, that kind of bat mitzvah still could not have happened. There's another moment where my mother dies, and I am able to cope with this and get through this with my community. And again, one of the great gifts of Judaism is our rituals of mourning and the instruction on how to do this and Shiva and funerals and all of that. And it's not unique to conservative Judaism. But you know what? I came to appreciate a distinctive way of speaking that is present in conservative congregations and among conservative Jews. There are things that are said and things that are not said. The tenor of it. Nobody lied to me. Nobody tried to sugarcoat it. But at the same time, nobody denied me the hope that I desperately needed at that point. So there's a kind of a discourse which is visible at that moment, which is visible at many other moments too, and we tend to take it for granted. But when you go to synagogues other than conservative synagogues, or read journals other than conservative journals, you realize that something really special happens in this movement, and one experiences it most powerfully, not academically, but existentially, in these personal moments. So I found it important to speak to conservative Jews about this, and to let them know that when you feel this too, and I feel this, where you're not unique, but there are hundreds of thousands of other Jews, over a million in the world today, over a million, not an inconsequential number, who are being touched by this kind of Judaism through our institutions. And as we said at the session before dinner, it's also not unimportant to recognize, as Elliot Dorf said, that if you look at the Klal Yisrael organizations that are keeping this people alive and strong in the United States, in Canada, and between North American Jews and Israel, and sometimes in other places, it's not just that we are disproportionately represented. We are heavily overrepresented in all these organizations, whether it's AIPAC or Federation or JCCs or Jewish Studies, both on the level of professionals and on the level of lay people. And if the Pew Report had only had a box to say, to measure commitment to Klal Yisrael and leadership in Klal Yisrael, then we would have scored extremely high. It's an occasion for conservative Jews to feel proud. And I said it before, and I'll say it again. Thanks to 21 years of membership in Congregation Kol Emet in California, as a Jew in the pew, I don't know if Rabbi Sarah Graff is here right now or not. Hi, Sarah. I'm able to say with a full heart that I know these Jews. And I would not trade those Jews for any Jews in the world. None. And therefore, this is a great asset, which we should not allow anyone else to minimize. And I found, to my dismay, not only that they were being minimized regularly, I was finding column after column belittling conservative Jews and treating them as less than serious Jews, but even more sad, I found that some conservative Jews were internalizing this message. And it was beginning to get to them, which is why, if you read my piece that I wrote in response to some of our critics, I allowed myself a little bit of anger to show, because I think we had every right to be irritated and angry, and sometimes it's good to let it show. So that's lesson number one, that we have a lot going for us, that the reports about our death are greatly exaggerated, we shouldn't put up with them, and they're not just misstatements, and they're not just schadenfreude. In many places, they were acts of competition for talent, for resources that should be coming our way, but will go elsewhere if people buy the lie that we are dying or JTS is dying or any other such nonsense that people have out there. You should all know that JTS made one of the few tenure track hires in Jewish studies in the entirety of North America this year. Someone who's joining our faculty next year. Our faculty is growing. Our institution is growing. Conservative Judaism is losing numbers, but we are much better off than all sorts of people have been saying we are. That is lesson number one, speaking passionately not just about conservative Judaism, but about conservative Jews. Then I want to say that the Pew Report did us a disservice by not providing context. So, there was a Pew Report in 2009 called Faith in Flux. Do you know that 44% of Americans who now believe in or practice some religion or other, practice or believe in a religion other than the one in which they were raised? 44%. That counts people who were Baptist and became like Presbyterians, or vice versa, as different, because among Protestants, those denominational differences are just as serious as the difference between Protestant and Catholic. So if people are moving around from Judaism elsewhere, that's because Americans are on the move. A 2012 Pew study was called Nuns on the Rise, N-O-N-E-S. Do you know that between 2007 and 2012, Christianity in this country lost 5% of its adherents? That's true. Some people died and were not replaced by other believers, but a lot of it is just Exodus, almost all of it from Protestantism. The Catholics are losing members, but holding their numbers because of Latino immigration. 5% in 5 years. That's 12 million people cease to be Christians in 5 years. The speed of change in this country is truly staggering. So again, if people are disaffiliating from Judaism, that's because religion is losing ground. The fundamentalists and evangelicals and Mormons have been losing ground or barely holding steady since the early 1990s. So when people say, what conservative Judaism did wrong because we lost some self-attribution in numbers, put it in some context, please, or don't make the statement. The third thing you all know, I think from Bowling Alone, is that membership numbers in every single organization are not just declining, they're plummeting. There's a great chart in Bowling Alone about PTA membership, compared from a high in 1960 to the present, and it's not because of working women. Women who do not work outside the home do not join PTAs any more than women who do work outside the home. All Americans are stopping to join organizations. So if they're leaving membership in conservative synagogues, it's because they're leaving membership, period. There's a new book out by Howard Gardner, a social psychologist at Harvard, called The App Generation. They now have data, it's the first data, hard data, I think, which shows that these things that we carry around in our pockets, these smartphones, have really already had an impact on the way people behave, on the way they think. There's evidence that the emotional intelligence of little girls has declined because they no longer play together, they text. There's evidence that relationships have suffered because of a huge growth in internet porn. There's all sorts of things happening in this culture which are so fast you can barely keep up with them, and that's the kind of thing you want to do to contextualize the Pew study. If our intermarriage data is high, and it is, know that according to the Pew Report, not our Pew report, the previous one, 50% of Americans at the moment are married to someone who was of a different religion at the time when they were married, and 33% of Americans are currently married to someone of a different religion. 33%. And the difference between the 50 and the 33 is apparently that in the previous generation, when a man married a woman of a different religion, the woman converted to the man's religion by and large. That has stopped. So now couples persist in having two different religions. So this is a crucial bit of context. Again, the context is America. My final bit of evidence for context comes from an article on the front page of the New York Times about 2 weeks ago. So there is a Saturday morning activity in this country, which many people consider a religion, which is losing drastic numbers. I'm talking about golf. You may have seen the story. Golf is losing numbers because it is considered too hard, takes up too much time, people don't feel competent at it, and they're less and less interested in committing to something week after week and doing things with other people in this sociable way. So golf is in trouble. They estimate that golf may lose 20% of its membership in the next 10 or 15 years. Sounds familiar, right? There are various reactions to this crisis. I read you from the New York Times. There is what you might call the reform reaction. No one's trying to drive away the many millions of people who play traditional golf, but what harm is there in offering an alternative? In 5 years, I bet that 90% of golf facilities are having events with a 15-inch hole. What? A 15-inch hole. There is the orthodox response. I don't want to rig the game and cheapen it, said Curtis Strange, a two-time United States Open champion. I don't like any of that stuff, and it's not going to happen either. It's all talk. Finally, there's what you might call the conservative response. A non-conforming club or ball does not corrupt the game, Mr. Miller said, not if it encourages people to try a very intimidating game that will be beneficial to golf for 50 years. So we are going to keep the tradition, but we're going to change it. So that's that lesson, all right? We've got change all around us. Then there is another lesson, which I call the confidence that our path is correct. So, we don't have the time this evening to belabor on this, but I wish you could all verify for yourselves, because I think there's a point at which ideas are crucial to our movement and always happen. And when you have the chance, as I do, to teach the history and philosophy of conservative Judaism over and over again, and moreover, to do so by and large with rabbinical students who are about to bet their careers on the compelling character of this tradition, you experience very powerfully a coherent line that starts with Frankel and goes to Schechter, ideologically is conveyed, could say, in various ways by Finkelstein, by Kaplan, by Heschel, and then comes down to the current generation and results in things like egalitarianism, position on women, what we've done with Magen Tzedek. There's a whole bunch of things that flow directly out of a tradition. It's not coincidence that we are so carefully identified with Israel and always have been. When you think about the fact that Frankel started this whole movement over the issue of Hebrew, when you think about the fact that Schechter said what he said in 1906 in that declaration on Zionism, and that this movement was firmly Zionist at a time when neither Reform nor Orthodoxy could be accused of being firmly Zionist. There have been certain characters to this movement all through. The fact that we were committed to both Halakha and to Agadah. The fact that we were committed not only to loyalty, to deep loyalty to Jewish tradition, but also to interfaith cooperation and dialogue on a major scale. With the fact that we saw an obligation to preach Judaism to the rest of the world and not just to keep it to ourselves. There's all sorts of commonalities, and were there time, we should publicize and be proud of the fact that there's a message here, and it's been consistent for a very long time. And so when we adapt it right now, that's what we're doing. I didn't feel myself at all a creator when I did this. I felt myself a translator, a communicator, who's trying to filter through my sensibility of my generation, and as a teacher of the next generation, what I had learned from my teachers. So there really is a coherent line there, and it's very important of us to present it as cogently and as coherently as we can. The path is a good path. I think that path is one that's going to sustain us. Now, I happen to bet, like Steve Wernick in the previous panel who said that he's not a prophet or the son of a prophet, none of us are, and I learned from my colleagues in demography and economics at Stanford that anyone who predicts out more than 20 years is a fool. That was their opinion. So we have all sorts of people telling us where the Jews are going to be, where conservative Judaism is going to be in 50 years. And I have it on the authority of my colleagues that the variables are too great to do anything more than 20 years, and even that depends on what we do. But tell me, if you were going to make a wager on what Judaism is going to succeed in the 21st century, not succeed in terms of numbers, because at the moment we're not going to succeed in terms of numbers because we don't have the ultra-Orthodox birth rate and the reform growth that comes from intermarriage. We have neither of those things working for us right now. And those are, according to Pew, the major sources of growth in Reform and in Orthodoxy. Not conservative Jews who leave conservative Judaism go to Orthodoxy and go to Reform. There are those people, of course they are, and they're significant. But that's not where the numbers are, and that's not where it's likely to be. Ask Steve Cohen. Orthodox growth will continue to come from birth rate, and Reform growth, as far as we can see, if it grows, will continue to grow from the non-Jewish spouses who join Reform congregations. So we're not going to have numbers. But if you were going to make a bet on the Judaism of the 21st century, would it be one that denies science and tries to keep faith firmly in a different pocket than the science and technological world in which we live? Yeah, you can use a smartphone without believing in the biology and the physics and the chemistry that is basic to that phone. You can deny that truth if you want to and just take advantage of the phone. But if you are a mind open to science, you can't do that. So is the kind of Judaism that lives going to be a Judaism that does that? I don't think so. That believes the world is literally 5,700 and some years old and denies the geology? I don't think so. Is the Judaism of the future one that's going to keep women behind a screen or in a balcony? I don't think so. Is it going to be one that waters itself down? No. Is it going to be one that separates ritual from ethics? Hardly likely. Because why, at a time when people have to choose it, would you choose something that you can get cheaper elsewhere? If you want a watered-down version of Judaism, you can buy it much more cheaply. You don't have to go for it as a Jew. I'm not saying that all reform is watered down. Please understand me. Of course there are substantive reform and Reconstruction Jews. Of course there are. We don't have a market on that. We don't have a monopoly on that. But I'm describing a kind of Judaism which we have. In this world, is it going to be a Judaism that's not firmly connected to the state of Israel? And we're not just firmly connected ideologically to the state of Israel, but as Julie mentioned in the previous panel, I think, if you look at the data which Jack Wertheimer and Steve Cohen have, you take the active conservative Jews, those who go to shul pretty regularly, those who send their kids to more than 5 years of Jewish schooling, those who send their kids to day school or a mock camp, those kinds of conservative Jews have figures of identification, visits, everything to Israel, not much less than Orthodox Jews do without enjoying the state monopoly in Israel that Orthodoxy enjoys. So there's a kind of a Judaism which we represent that I think does own the future in that sense. Not because I'm a prophet, because look at where we are, look at where we're all going, look at the kind of thing that we're holding on offer to people, and the product that we offer is really, I think, unbeaten by anyone else. And I believe, and Steve Cohen thinks we have the data to prove this, that even though our numbers are shrinking, and that's painful, of course it's painful, institutions are closing. That is sad. People devote their lives to things, and those things are not going to have a future in the next generation. But The project as a whole is doing well and gaining steam. And I appreciate the fact that my friend Steve Cohen believes that if you had to put money on a movement that's going to succeed in the next generation, it would not be modern orthodoxy and it would not be reform. It'd be conservative plus the niche for ultra-orthodoxy that's secured by the high walls and the birth rate that are going to keep ultra-orthodoxy going for the next generation, at least in the strong fashion that it's going now. Lesson number five is, as I said earlier, institutions matter. I did not appreciate the degree to which institutions matter, of course, until I became Chancellor of JTS. I became Chancellor of JTS because I wanted to help shape the next generation of leaders, and especially rabbis, knowing that I myself was gifted with a whole series of rabbis who invested greatly in me and changed my life. So I wanted to help do that as well. And now I find that unless you invest in institutions, you can't get anywhere. And so you wonder why we don't have the money to spend on campus that the Orthodox have to spend on campus. And the answer is Kashrut certification, pure and simple. Tens of millions of dollars that come in through Kashrut certification and go out in Orthodox outreach, especially on campus. It's not that the product is inferior. Does any other movement have the net outflow of capital that we do precisely because we contribute ideology and leadership to Klal Yisrael organizations? We also contribute money to Klal Yisrael organizations to a much greater extent than Orthodoxy or Reform do, whose money stays inward in those movements to a much larger extent than conservative money stays inside conservative Judaism. This is a huge factor in our numerical decline. Imagine the growth in numbers that we too could experience if we had the money that would come to furnish those institutions. There was a time, I think, that we were badly organized, etc. I think we're doing much better now, and our problem now, as Steve Wernick said, is that we are severely under-resourced. And I see this all the time because I see the difference that JTS is making and can make, and the ways that we're partnering with other parts of the movement, and the growth that's inhibited by lack of money on our side. I know that all of my organizations and all of you have the same issue. I assume that scarcity of resources is always going to be with us. But I would plead with us all to see if we can galvanize our members to keep a little more resources at home, as it were, knowing that the impact will be felt not just inside the conservative movement, but throughout all of American Judaism. Everybody tells me all the time, thank God for JTS, thank God for conservative Judaism, because without you, not only could the center not hold, but where would modern Orthodoxy be? Where would the move toward tradition that Reform has engaged in over the last 20 years, how would that happen? And I thank them very much and ask them if they're willing to support JTS. But I can tell you that JTS, like all of you, gets virtually not a cent from any Orthodox source and not a whole lot of cents, not a whole lot of dollars from Reform sources. And the conservative money is supporting Chabad in the many millions of dollars and all sorts of other institutions. And it's hard to begrudge it. You want Klal Yisrael to be strong. But I really do believe they were crucial, and we need these kinds of resources. I want to draw to the conclusion by saying one final word. And I got to teach Rosenzweig this morning, and we're almost at Shavuot. So let me just introduce my last thought by saying a word that I wouldn't have felt so strongly had Rosenzweig not talked about Revelation of Mount Sinai in the Star of Redemption in the way he did. If you haven't read The Star of Redemption, I can't recommend that you read The Star of Redemption. Right? Right? Elliot, yes? You want to recommend? No. But the passage on Revelation, there's a couple pages there that are pure gold. And what Rosenzweig says is the heart of commandment is love. How can anyone command love? The lover can command love. The lover by loving commands love. Rosenzweig taught me again that mitzvah is about love. And if I could just share with you a teaching that may be pshita to you, but is the opposite of pshita to me, because I didn't understand it as fully as I do now, and now I feel quite passionately about it. To me, the great mitzvah and the great gift of conservative Judaism is it offers me the possibility of wholeness. Wholeness. So, we all just read Vayikra again, and I got to teach it, many of you got to teach it, and it struck me yet again. You look at Parshat Kedoshim. Kedoshim, holiness is not about Mother Teresa, and it's not about some Buddhist monk in an orange robe. Holiness is about the weights and measures in the marketplace. It's about worship, and it's about ritual, and it's about how those are inseparable from personal ethics and inseparable from societal ethics. It's all one piece. It refuses to separate them. And when I look at Judaism, and I see other kinds of Judaism saying to me, you can be a Jew, but don't come too close to the arts of your culture. Stay away from the science of your culture, because it might corrupt your mind. They're denying me an attempt at wholeness. And when I put it the other way around, when I look at where conservative Judaism stems from, what's the origin of conservative Judaism, for me, it's in that commandment to love the Lord my God, not just with part of my heart, but with all of it. Not just with part of my soul, but with all of it. Not just with part of me, but with all of the fact, all of what makes me myself, all my veriness, all my od. And we know that our tradition refuses to separate this love of God from love of humanity. And then I started thinking about how important this wholeness was. And if you think about the fact that the Shema, of all the things it could have chosen to say about Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, our God, says only one thing about this God, which is that this God is Echad. Is one. And then Sefer Dvarim follows without pause the fact that this God is one with a commandment and opportunity that I have to bless this God and be Bechol. And so I spent a lot of time meditating this year, and just pass it on to you for whatever it's worth, on the connection between the Echadness of God and the Becholness that has opened up to me. Where would I be as a human being without the possibility of wholeness that is laid out before me in the Via Hafta? And I think it has to do with this Echadness of God. Now, I'm intimidated because my colleague Ben Summer is here in front of me. So let me just say that I would go one step further in this drash and say that all through Deuteronomy, including the same chapter where the Shema Nevi Ahavtu appear, the word et is used in another way than as a direct object. It's used to mean with. And I don't put it past any great poetry to use words in more than one sense at the same time, and so I certainly don't put it past Sefer Torah to use the word et both as a direct object and as a with. And so if my fondest wish for life is that my life be a life of loving the Lord my God and loving the fellow creatures of the Lord my God, it is also a fond wish which the Torah promises me can be fulfilled, that in so far as I do this, I do it with God. Ve'ahavta et Hashem Elohecha. And because I love with God, I get to love with all my becholness, with all my allness, with all of our allness. And I find of all the movements of Judaism that are out there, the one that in this day holds out the greatest promise of wholeness, which the Torah put before us, and which Chazal laid before us, and which Rambam puts before us, etc., etc., that movement is ours. That kind of Judaism is the one we stand for. So, of course, we're not perfect. I can tell you all the things that are wrong with conservative Judaism. I don't know a single conservative Jew who can't tell you all the things that are wrong with conservative Judaism. But this is something that's profoundly right about conservative Judaism. And to my mind, this, above all else, this is what is going to sustain us. This is going to what is make us strong, because this kind of Judaism, ours, is grounded in nothing less than the Shema Nevi'a Haftah in this very concrete and tangible way. That's why it's such a privilege to be the Chancellor of JTS and to work with you all on making sure that this kind of Judaism of ours stays strong for many, many decades to come. Thank you very much.
Good evening, everyone. Just briefly, I want to take a couple of minutes to thank everyone who participated in the joint campaign this year. Like our colleague Brad Artson said just a few hours ago at the previous session, there is no doubt and there's a reality that our institutions are separate institutions. But there's another reality that goes together with that one, which is the Rabbinical Assembly is a thread that binds all of these institutions together. And with that comes a mantle of leadership and the mantle of responsibility in the conservative movement. I think that when you look at what we're able to accomplish with the joint campaign supporting all of our institutions that we love and hold so dear, you really understand the power that we hold in our hands to bring this movement together, not necessarily by bringing the institutions together, but by binding them together. And that's really something that is both humbling and at the same time very telling of who we are. I want to thank every single one of you who responded to my calls, my emails, whatever form of communication it was. And I have to tell you that being someone that calls often other colleagues for different causes, the joint campaign is something that no one ever says no to. And that's a wonderful thing. And this year was very, very successful. It was successful because I think we believe in what we're doing. And we also, of course, have a tremendous amount of love for Amy. So thank you again. Let us keep on doing the work that we do so well, inspiring, leading so many thousands of Jews on all the contexts and the places in which we do, which are very different from one to another. And I would like to once again call upon Chancellor Eisen to introduce our honoree.
So it's always an honor for me to introduce the honoree of the joint campaign, and this evening is not just an honor, but it's a deep pleasure because Amy is an old and dear friend. We raised our kids together in Palo Alto, California. We shared a wonderful congregation and its wonderful rabbis together. We were in the same chavura. We have many close friends in common. And it's a great pleasure to have known my honoree as up close as I've had a chance to do over some, how many years now? 20, I don't know, we can't even count them, a long, long time, and to be able to present her to you this evening. So let me just say three or four things about Amy that stand out to someone who knows her up close, has watched her from a near distance, and has watched her from afar. First of all, we honor Amy, of course, as one of the original cohort of women to enter and be ordained by JTS. I don't want to leave out any names. I don't know if you were planning to mention them, but Nina, Bieber, Feinstein, and there are others in your class. 18 of you. And so we're honoring not just Amy, but that group this evening. That group has acquitted itself with incredible creativity, dignity, responsibility, excitement. And Amy has borne this mantle of being the first woman rabbi and the first woman on the law committee with great distinction. Having been at Kol Emet all those years, I've had the chance to see Amy be rabbi and be Shaliach Tzibur. If you have not heard Amy Alberg do a Musaf and the Ilo on Yom Kippur, you've been deprived. If you have not heard Amy Alberg teach a class, you've been deprived. If you've not seen Amy Alberg minister to people in need in all sorts of ways and heard their testimonies about the impact she's made on them, you've been deprived. It's a source of great inspiration. So Amy, as rabbi, has been quite distinguished. Some of you may not know that Amy is a co-founder of the Bay Area Center on Jewish Healing. That Center on Jewish Healing, like others, brought support and succor and strength to a lot of Jews in an hour of need. Being it was, as it was in the Bay Area, which was, as it were, ground zero for the AIDS crisis, and the Bay Area Center on Healing came online in time to greet that crisis, there was a special degree of responsibility and healing that Amy exercised there. She also, in the context of that center, served as the co-founder of the Yedidya Center for Jewish Spiritual Direction, again adding a dimension that had often been lacking to our tradition, which Catholics and others had excelled in. I got to say a few words in this week's portion about Amy's work as peacemaker. Her book is on sale outside, and I think Amy will have a few words to say about this. For years, Amy has taken it as her mission, and I think it's fair to say, whether she would say it or not, as someone who knows her, it's a real calling. Because the marriage between Amy's personal gifts and the work of dialogue and reconciliation, it is a perfect match. This work is not meant for everybody. Not everybody can do it well. Not everybody can do it credibly. Whether you're talking about Jews and Christians having really hard conversations of the sort that don't happen even in many Jewish-Christian dialogue groups, whether you're talking about Jews and Muslims, whether you're talking about Palestinians and Israelis, or whether you're talking about American Jews who can barely talk to one another civilly because of the fact that we disagree about Israel, Amy has worked in all of these contexts, has long experience in bringing people together, and has taught us a great deal about peacemaking. I had the chance in my JTS Parsha column of this week to talk in some detail about how Amy's work, in my view, relates to Parshat Bahar. But all of us, I think, can appreciate the greatness of this work and its difficulty. So, Amy, I have to say that in terms of Aser Lecha Rav and Kneel Lecha Chaver and Havedana Kol Adam Achav Zechut, thank goodness that JTS helped you be a rabbi and that you and your classmates made you a rabbi. Thank goodness we're living in this moment of American history where I can't imagine you being anything else than a rabbi. Thank God it was possible to fulfill this calling. Those of us who've had the joy and the privilege of being your friend know the dimension that adds to our lives. And you, as much as anyone, have taught me, not just by word, but by example, what it means to judge other people. That is something, if I can say this, in which you are really good, Amy. You do that, and you do it apparently effortlessly. And you make hardened souls take the possibility seriously. Amy, you are the real deal. You have been a great rabbi and trained rabbis and inspired rabbis and taught rabbis. And in becoming a woman rabbi, you exemplify this possibility that many of us hoped for, that you wouldn't simply be a woman entering a male profession, but a woman who changes the profession because you, a woman, are in it. And so for all those reasons, I am really excited and proud to call you up to accept the honor of the RA, of all of our joint campaign.
Thank you so much. It's extraordinary looking out at all of your faces, all the things that we do together. They're just some precious moments when we're together and being loved at one another. That's what I felt, of course, with Arnie. Thank you. But from all of you, so it's very moving standing here before you and with you, and I am so grateful, of course, for the honor, and most especially for the kind wishes. We have two compliment rabbis here, of course. You were talking about Sarah and Arnel Lori. Artie and I share the same rabbis. Two out of three of whom are here. So I'm very, very, very grateful for everything that went into this, Felipe, for your extraordinary work on the campaign, and for the remarkable planning that this evening happens on the day that is the anniversary of my ordination. And let's hear it. A shout out to the class of 1985. It was May 12th. How many of my classmates were here? 12 was ordained on May 12th, 1985. So not to be missed. But I'll have more to say about the class with whom I entered the seminary than with whom I left. It is absolutely clear to me, despite all the very kind things that Arnie said, and also as Arnie said, that the choice to honor me in this way at the start of the 30th year of my rabbinate is in a very meaningful way an expression of the celebration of all of the women of the RA. And I think it's pretty obvious who are the women of the RA in the room, but I would really ask those women who entered in 1984 to stand, because this absolutely belongs to you as well. So this is an opportunity to celebrate Susan Grossman and Deborah Ornstein and the other 13 women who entered in that pioneering first class. So 2014 is an anniversary for all of us. And in some ways, it's been a long 30 years. Those early years for us women of the first couple of classes were extraordinary. And they were not altogether easy years. We regularly experienced the kind of scrutiny that pioneers so often face. We had to be better, as women so often do. Smarter, more eloquent, more savvy, and more graceful, in order for some to be convinced that we really belonged, that we had a right to be here. Within the RA, while the decision to admit us was celebrated, it took some time for recognition to emerge that we were a distinct group of rabbis with special gifts, unique potential for the movement, and particular obstacles that still lay in our path. And how could it have been otherwise? The RA had just made an enormous change, and there were understandable concerns about what our arrival would mean, fears about whether the movement would fracture, and more deeply, apprehension about what kinds of changes our presence might bring for good and perhaps for ill. We did everything we could to calm those fears in ourselves and in others, mostly by being ourselves, by doing our sacred work, by focusing on the blessings and opportunities of the moment rather than on frustration about the slow pace of change. We talked about the annoyances during those delicious times when we would come together at a conference, close the door, I remember one in particular at JTS, and allow ourselves to tell one another the litany of stories about how some people had trivialized us with their silly comments about our attire, our shoes, about kissing the rabbi, and the one that we've heard over and over and over and over again about what to call the rabbi's husband. We turned to one another for strength, for sisterhood, and laughter, and then we walked back into our lives to continue our Melechet HaKodesh. The work of the women of the RA has been extraordinary. We have served congregations, Hillels, and a wide range of educational and communal institutions. We've worked as chaplains and counselors and we have served the movement first as the only woman on a particular committee, but now as an important and natural presence at all levels of movement leadership. We've done the things that all rabbis do: teach Torah, celebrate Smachot, bury the dead and comfort the mourners, lead prayer, build vibrant and inspiring communities, and bring people closer to God. As some of us knew from the start, and as Arnie alluded to, as women we brought unique gifts and perspectives into the rabbinate. Some of us pioneered new areas of rabbinic engagement, including in Jewish healing, Jewish spirituality, and peacemaking, and in the envisioning of new kinds of Jewish community. Some have brought new perspectives on Jewish theology, midrash, ritual creation, and on Jewish law. Collectively, we have published a great deal of our own writing, much of it groundbreaking. All of us serve every day as living symbols of equality, inviting all Jews to experience themselves as treasured assets to our communities, welcome in leadership, and without any question, created and unfolding in the image of the divine. We faced some particular trials because we were women rabbis. We encountered challenges to our leadership and authority from some of the people we served. We coped with unresolved halacha questions about our roles. We confronted sexism from search committees who claimed that rabbis who looked like us were just not quite the right fit for their congregations. We struggled and struggled against stained glass ceilings and for the principle of equal pay for equal work. And at times we have faced what can only be called sexual harassment. Thank God we have come a very long way. Some of the challenges of those early years have receded into distant memory. We've had a female president of the RA, Gila Dror, who preceded me in receiving this honor. Where's Gila? Jan Kaufman, of course, as senior staff. Not a woman, but I want to acknowledge Elliot Schoenberg, who understood women's issues just about as well as any woman would. Of course, he's married to one. Where's Elliot? And of course, Julie Schoenfeld's leadership, which is extraordinarily, regardless of her gender, embodies a powerful symbolism as she has moved the concerns of the women of the RA squarely into the center of the life of our movement. And we all owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to Julie for her leadership, and so I can say with conviction rather than just hope that the obstacles that continue to obstruct the path to full equality and dignity for women in the movement will continue to be addressed with determination, integrity, and clarity of vision. But permit me to share another thought with you this evening, while I have my moment at the Amud, and Arnie was very kind to give me some free publicity for my newly published book. So Arnie began to tell you a little bit about what I've been doing for the past 10 years, engaged in a journey to understand the nature of conflict and encounter with difference, interpersonally, communally, and globally, culminating in the recent publication of my book, From Enemy to Friend, Jewish Wisdom and the Pursuit of Peace, published by Orbis, a wonderful Roman Catholic publisher who doesn't generally come to the RA. So the sale of the book is being handled by the United Synagogue Book Service, for which I'm very grateful. During these years, I've thought deeply about how human beings relate to difference, often trying to wipe out people who are different or think differently than ourselves, sometimes to wipe them out through physical violence, or sometimes doing spiritual or intellectual violence to the reality of diversity in God's world. When I teach about the difference between machloket l'shem shamayim and shalom l'shem shamayim, I'm often reminded of that absurd moment in the show My Fair Lady. Arnie didn't tell you that He and I are both lovers of Broadway musicals, and we pass that on to our children. Remember the moment in My Fair Lady when Professor Higgins laments, "Why can't a woman be more like a man?" We so readily recognize the absurdity of this perspective. Obviously, women are not supposed to be more like men, nor men, for the most part, more like women. Granting equality to women did not require that we blind ourselves to gender-based differences in socialization, nor to impediments to the actualization of women's work in the world. Gradually, we have learned as a community that women rabbis are rabbis, just as we all are, and not all rabbis are alike. There are differences between North American and South American and Israeli rabbis, even sometimes between East Coast and West Coast rabbis. There are differences between gay rabbis and straight rabbis, between AIPAC rabbis and J Street rabbis, between institutional and post-denominational rabbis, just as there are differences between men and women. If we try to pretend that the differences do not exist, or try to wish them away, or force them away, we will fail to address the real barriers that block the full expression of the minority group, and yes, women are still a minority in the RA, and we will fail to recognize the beauty of the diverse paths that we each walk in our shared vocation. In recent years, I've been studying and teaching and writing about what Jewish texts have said about diversity, about machloket, about conflict, and about peace. I'm reminded of a beautiful text I learned from our rabbi, one of the rabbis from Coleman, who's not in the room, Rabbi Sheldon Lewis, the author of an extraordinary book called Torah of Reconciliation, a beautiful collection of Jewish texts on peace arranged according to the Parsha. Shelley discovered an exquisite text from Rav Kook in his commentary to the Siddur. Writing on the Talmudic passage, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Amar Rabbi Chanina, Talmidei Chachamim, Marbim Shalom Ba'olam, Shenemar V'chol Banaich Limudei Adonai V'Rav Shalom Banaich. Rav Kook writes, Ish To'im, Shechoshvim Shashalom Ha'olami, Lo Yibane, Ki'im Al Yedei Tzivyon Echad B'deot U'tchunot. There are those who err, thinking that global peace will not be built except by means of identity in points of view and qualities. Therefore, when they see Talmidei Chachamim inquiring into wisdom and the knowledge of Torah, and by means of their searching, their perspectives and approaches multiply, they believe that they thus cause argument and the opposite of peace. Yet truthfully, he continues, this is not so. For the true peace cannot come into the world except by means of the value of ribui hashalom, a multiplicity of peace. Rav Kook continues, it does not say gadol shalom banaich, which would point to a picture of one great body, which would fit that imagined idea that peace requires unified, identical words and ideas, which in truth diminishes the power of wisdom and the broadening of knowledge. For the light of knowledge, he says, must spread to all of its aspects, to all of the facets of the light within it. Rather, ribui, multiplicity, is the meaning of Rav Shalom Banaich, great is the peace of your children. Many people think that shalom requires a presumption of sameness, the wiping out of alternative points of view or enforced consensus. In fact, the greater shalom of harmony and wholeness requires recognition of the magnificent multiplicity that is an intentional part of God's creation. God's world is far more beautiful for its infinite variety of flora and fauna. God's master craftsmanship is most evident in the boundless array of human beings, each of us, B'Tselem Elokim, yet each of us with our own unique appearance, temperaments, and gifts, and yes, our own religious, political, and communal perspectives. It seems to me that the celebration of the women in the movement, in a deeper sense, beautifully honestly expresses a theology of diversity that emerges directly from Jewish sources. We are not all supposed to be the same. There are differences in how we carry ourselves as leaders, different perspectives on how our communities and institutions should be structured, where our movement is going, and, of course, different ways of understanding halakhic and political issues. Now that the presence of women rabbis has proceeded into its second generation, I'd like to see us embrace this deeper meaning of women and men working together in the rabbinate as a metaphor for how we are to engage with difference in our lives, in our communities, and in the movement. Sameness is not a worthy goal. Jews do not seek the eradication of disagreement. We should not pursue a single answer to the challenges that face our movement in this time of radical change. Just as Ralph Cook asks us to seek harmony and wholeness in the grand beauty of multiple views, we should cultivate the ability to celebrate the differences among us. Not because we can't decide who we are, but because it is a multiplicity of perspectives that can bring us closer to productive engagement with the challenges of the day, to truth, and to God. Al tikri banaich, ela bonaich. As we and coming generations of rabbis of all genders, paths, viewpoints continue to build Jewish life for the 21st century, may we build it not by merely tolerating diversity among us or excluding those perspectives we find challenging, but by embracing and thanking God for it all. For only in this way, I think, will our children and our children's children be well and whole and in harmony. And may the tradition we treasure continue to flourish. Thank you for being such wonderful partners.